From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Today, Barney Frank, the former Democratic congressman from Massachusetts, talks about being a gay legislator fighting for gay rights. Frank became the first sitting member of Congress to enter a same-sex marriage, but when he started his political career in the late 60s, he was closeted.
I began by being repressed. I evolved into being closeted. I was terrified.
Although he remained in the closet for many years, Frank first sponsored gay rights bills back in the 70s when he was in the Massachusetts state legislature.
And people would be very open and say, hey, pal, are you kidding? I'm not going to have some dyke in my store. You think I want some bleep bleep guy hanging around where I might have kids?
Barney Frank's new memoir is called Frank. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Brandi Carlile's new album. He says it's her best yet. That's on Fresh Air. Thanks for listening to Fresh Air. You might also want to listen to Microphone Check, hosted by Ali Shaheed Muhammad from A Tribe Called Quest and Franny Kelly. They talk to the biggest names in hip-hop and the best-kept secrets, from behind-the-scenes players to the next generation of rappers, producers, and artists. You'll learn what's happening in the culture now and how we got here. You can find Microphone Check at npr.org/podcasts. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In his new memoir, my guest Barney Frank, the former Democratic congressman from Massachusetts, writes that in 1954, when he was 14, he realized there were two ways in which he was different from the other guys. He was attracted to the idea of serving in government, and he was attracted to the other guys. Frank assumed being gay would make a career in politics impossible, yet he managed to do it. But in order to do it, he spent a lot of time in the closet. Even when he was closeted, he fought for gay rights legislation. He was elected to Congress in 1980 after serving 8 years in the Massachusetts legislature. He came out in 1987 and in 2012 became the first member of Congress to enter into a same-sex marriage. He describes his new memoir, Frank, as a personal history of two seismic shifts in American life: the sharp drop in prejudice against LGBT people and the equally sharp increase in anti-government opinion. Barney Frank, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to talk with you. You write that you initially resisted a life in politics because you knew it meant being closeted, but when you decided to pursue politics and enter public life in 1968, had you yet experienced what you knew you'd have to give up? Had you yet had an out, open relationship with another man?
No. I began by being repressed. I evolved into being closeted. I was terrified. Remember, there's no reason for you to remember, but this is 1954. 1953 is when I actually first realized I was gay. It was 54 when I focused and said, gee, I want to go into politics, but how's that going to work when I'm part of this group that people despise? And I was too frightened to do anything, and in particular, given that I was thinking about at least a semi-public kind of thing, well, I take it back. I didn't even know how to meet people. I'm talking now about the 50s and the 60s, even putting myself in a position where I would have a chance to meet another man for some kind of serious relationship. I didn't know how to do it, and I was intimidated if somebody had told me.
So you started your political career in the late 60s in local politics. So the start of your political career coincides with the start of the widespread gay rights movement and Stonewall. So just as gay people are coming out, you're kind of locking the closet door to start a career in politics. How did it feel to be knowing that you were doing that at a time when gay culture was becoming more and more open and rich?
It became a frustration. Actually, the exact timing for me was I was working for the mayor of Boston when Stonewall happened. And I have to say that being the chief assistant to the mayor, what I remember from 1969 with the Vietnam War demonstrations and other very serious kinds of issues. And, of course, I'd been there when Martin Luther King had been murdered. So I do not remember focusing that well on Stonewall. It was only really after I retired, which was a year later, early 71, that I had the kind of intellectual and emotional space to think about other things. And at that point, I did say, oh, yeah, there was this new thing going on. And it really came to a head because in 1972, so now 3 years after Stonewall, I decided I was going to run for the state legislature. And I also decided at that time very explicitly, I remember this, to myself, okay, I cannot be open about my sexuality because I'll never win and I want to do that. I want to be involved in ways that I think make society better. But I'm not going to be a hypocrite. I could not live with myself if I did not oppose the discrimination. And so in 1972, actually, there were two organizations, one of men and one of women, that did a circulation to people running for the state legislature saying, would you support a gay rights bill or would you sponsor it? And I said, great, of course I'll sponsor it. Fortunately, I'm a freshman. There'll be senior members who will be sponsoring as well, and they'll take the lead. So I won't be out front, which I was a little afraid of because I was 32, unmarried. Well, are people going to draw inferences? What happens then is that I'm the only member of the legislature running that year who won, who said he'd sponsor the bill. So I wound up becoming the main sponsor. And then, but exactly the tension you were talking about then came into play. Throughout the 70s, I became more and more an active and prominent leader on gay rights, and I was increasingly depressed by the disparity between my advocating the rights for everybody else and then denying myself any chance to participate in it.
So you were kind of afraid that if you took a leading role in gay rights legislation, as you did, that it would give away that you were gay, which you were trying to hide. Did it give away that you were gay to people you didn't want to tell that to?
No, it was an odd thing. There did not appear to be any widespread perception. It is interesting. Increasingly, gay men and some lesbians understood that I was gay. Gay men in particular. I asked one man who I came out to later in that in the 70s who I'd been working with, and he said, well, yeah, of course I knew that. I said, well, how'd you know that? He said, I watched your eyes. He said, we'd be walking around, and you were looking at the same guys I was looking at. So, but straight people had no idea what I was doing with my eyes. And so I became the leading advocate of the gay rights movement in the state of Massachusetts, and it did not seem to send many signals to people. Part of what I would say is this. There was at that time these stereotypes of what it meant to be gay, and I did not conform. I mean, in some good ways and some bad ways, I did not have some of the sensibilities about some things that many gay men have. I didn't dress that way. I was at that point. I gained a lot of weight and I smoked cigars. It just did not. I guess my aspect discouraged that inference.
You were elected to the U.S. Congress in 1980, the same year as Ronald Reagan was elected president. At this point in time, the Christian right was becoming increasingly powerful and politicized. And the Christian right, of course, you know, has opposed, especially then really opposed, gay rights bills that you advocated. By 1981, when you were sworn in, you could no longer say overtly racist things in Congress. If you were afraid of black people, you couldn't come out and say that. If you thought they were inferior, you couldn't come out and say that. You had to couch that in other language. If you wanted to oppose certain rights legislation, you couldn't do it overtly. You had to find like more roundabout ways of doing it. But if you were anti-gay, no problem. You could come out and say that. You could say that being gay was a sin against God. You could say gay people shouldn't teach. Gay people shouldn't marry. Gay people should convert to heterosexuality. So I'm wondering, what were some of the most disturbing things you heard your fellow congressmen say or heard people lobbying your fellow congressmen saying?
Well, first of all, let me just underline, you make a very important point about it became inappropriate to be explicitly racist. You know, we've all developed analytically the concept of the dog whistle, that is, of politicians appealing to racial sentiments but in ways that aren't explicit, so that other racists will know what they're talking about. Well, it really even began in 73, and I've noted this. I began lobbying for the gay rights bill, as we then called it. There was just the one name. And people would be very open and say, hey, pal, are you kidding? I'm not going to have some dyke in my store. You think I want some bleep guy hanging around where I might have kids? So, yeah, it was unrestrained. And then in 1981, the first issue I dealt with in Congress, the District of Columbia had repealed its criminal law against sodomy, against people of the same sex having voluntary sex with each other. And at that time, there was a rule that either House of Congress could pass a law and cancel anything in the criminal area that the District of Columbia did. And the House passed that, canceling it by a 3-to-1 margin. Even many Democrats voted against it. I got barely a majority of the Democrats. And when I went around lobbying, it was, again, these people are disgusting. Are you kidding, pal, what they do? Oh, that turns my stomach. I can't allow that to happen.
So you couldn't really say, did you know I'm gay, because you weren't out yet. What would you say in response to that?
At that point, it was not look, when you're in a legislative body, you try to win the argument on the easiest grounds to win the argument. Obviously, I disagreed with the moral disapproval, but it was unnecessary for me to win that one. It's almost like arguing in court. You focus on what you can win, and I would say to them, well, nobody's asking you to like it or not like it or approve it or not approve it. The only question is, don't prevent other people. It doesn't hurt you. And that was the argument. And by the way, that evolved into the argument with which I think we were successful on same-sex marriage. You begin by saying, nobody's asking you to say this is moral. Nobody's asking you to give up whatever view you have that this is a bad thing, or the later we progress to that. At this point, all we're asking you to do is leave people alone. And even if people are doing something that you disapprove of, if it has no impact on you whatsoever, if it has no negative impact on anybody else, it's simply what these two people are doing. Please don't mistreat them because of it. And that's, as I said, basically the way we started with same-sex marriage as well.
But then, of course, there was the argument, no, but if gay people get married, that hurts the institution of marriage. That hurts straight people who are married.
You're absolutely right. And by the way, I think that's why one of the reasons we ultimately win. And your question is really quite good in getting at that. By the time the Defense of Marriage Act came up, which is now 1995, 96, we had made some progress. So just as you correctly pointed out, by 1981, even people who had racist feelings didn't feel comfortable in articulating them. By the 90s, it was not considered respectable to talk about fags and dykes and to be very abusive about people. You could be disapproving, but you had to moderate it. So the real argument against our being able to marry was, as I said, look, there were people who didn't like one of us, and the notion of two of us getting together and being happy was geometrically worse. But they couldn't come out and say that. It was not at that time acceptable, respectable to say, hey, we don't like those people and we don't want them hanging out with each other and being happy. So they came up with this notion, and that's why it was called the Defense of Marriage Act. To be intellectually honest, it should have been, we don't want those people to be able to get together act. But they had to come up with supposed negative social consequences. And one of the reasons that we were able to win this battle was they made the mistake, because once Massachusetts broke the logjam and started same-sex marriage, it became undeniably clear that there were no adverse consequences. So they had built their arguments on a false premise. But you correctly said, oh, it's the institution of marriage. In a debate on the Defense of Marriage Act, I got on the floor and said, I want to understand, how does the fact that I love another man hurt your marriage? What about my relations, voluntary relations with another guy, in any way jeopardizes your marriage? And I said, I'll yield to any member of the House who wants to explain to me how what I would do would hurt your marriage. And one guy got up, Steve Largent from Oklahoma, and he said, well, I'll tell the gentleman this. No, it doesn't hurt my marriage. It doesn't hurt the marriage of other people here, but it hurts the institution of marriage. And my response was, well, it doesn't hurt any individual marriages, but despite that it somehow hurts the institution of marriage, that is an argument that ought to be made by someone in an institution.
Do you dream these lines up in advance?
Not often. They kind of come to me. I'm lucky that way. You know, there are some things I'm not very good at, but I like humor. And some of them, the best humor is offered up to you by the stupidity of your opponents.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Barney Frank, the former Democratic congressman from Massachusetts, has a new memoir called Frank. So in Congress, you adopted what you called a hybrid status. You were out, and this is earlier in your career, you were out to LGBT people, but not publicly to colleagues, the voters, or as you put it, other heterosexuals. And so you would describe yourself as being so wrapped up in the job that you just don't have time or a need for a private life. Did the idea of calling yourself a confirmed bachelor seem too old-fashioned?
What you cited, this notion, oh, he's so wrapped up in his public life, he gets so much satisfaction from being this public figure. He doesn't need a private life. I actually never cited that myself. In fact, I have cited that as a big lie that people tell themselves and tell about others, because in my experience, what happens, and it happens with me, not only is a thriving, successful public life no substitute for the emotional and physical needs human beings have in their private lives and in their intimate personalities, but in fact, it can make it worse. For me, there was this increasing disparity between success, good reinforcements about what I did publicly, including, at that point, full participation in these celebrations as we began to win some things on gay rights, and then a total denial, self-imposed, of me being able to deal with it. And so, in fact, I found that the successful public life made it even worse.
So when you decided that you were going to come out, like, you needed a strategy. Are you going to make an announcement, hold a press conference, talk to the press? What were some of your considerations and how to do it so that you could do it on your terms? And what were your terms?
By 86, members of the media who were sophisticated knew that I was gay. So I had this series of conversations with them in which they said, "We'd like to write about your being gay. Can we do that?" And I would say, "No, I'm not ready for that." And they would say, "Okay." Meanwhile, the Boston Globe, which was then very much the dominant paper in New England for Massachusetts, and with whom I had good relations then — that's when it was still possible to have good relations with a media outlet. They've all mostly now become headhunters. And the editor of the Boston Globe, a man named Bob Healy — again, I recount this — when that book came out, he heard about it in 86, and he came to see me in Washington, and he said, "Look, I don't want to intrude on your privacy, but we can't afford to be scooped on this. If somebody else is going to identify you, we have to be in on that. Now, we won't do it on our own." So I made him a promise, because I knew that no one was going to out me without calling me for comment. So my promise to him was, "Bob, look, if I get a phone call from any media outlet anywhere that's going to write about my being gay, because I won't deny it if I'm asked, I will call you up instantly, and you can at least be simultaneous with them." And he found that acceptable. So when I decided I wanted to come out, I had this commitment to the Globe, and it was a mutually beneficial. The Globe was a very influential paper. We were in sync ideologically. They'd been very helpful to me in my career. And so I was eager to have that announcement come in the Boston Globe. I thought that would be the most favorable setting. But then there was a second complication that I've alluded to. I did not want to make the announcement because I wanted to be able to say, "You know what, it's no big deal." Well, if I had held a press conference to announce it, it would be reasonable for people to say, "Well, if it's no big deal, why did you make a big deal of it? Why did you initiate a discussion?" I wanted to be able to say, "Look, the fact that I'm gay shouldn't have anything to do with this." Then the question is, well, why did you interject it? So what I told the Boston Globe was this: "If you ask me if I am gay, I will answer yes. I will tell you that I am. But I don't want to be the one that initiates it. It was important for me," and this sounds silly by now, but this is 27 or 8 years ago, "you have to ask me." The Globe then said, "Well, we can't ask you. Our rule is we do not initiate conversations with people about their being gay unless they were in some kind of problem where it was relevant." So we had a little standoff for a couple of months, seriously, where I said, "If you ask me, I'll tell you." And they said, "We can't ask you. Please tell us." And what happened finally was the Globe got nervous that there was so much talk about me going around that they were going to get scooped. So I got a phone call and said, "Okay, we're going to ask you." And they sent a reporter, a woman, a lesbian, who I'd known, down to Washington, and she put the tape recorder on the desk and said, "Congressman Frank, are you gay?" And I had thought about what I was going to say. And remember, my strategy was minimization, honesty, but saying it was not a big deal. And so my explicit answer was, "Ready for it, prepared. Congressman Frank, are you gay? Answer, yeah, so what?"
So what changed for you in Congress once you were out?
In Congress, what apparently changed was, and this goes back to the very good point you made about the impact on your personality of being closeted, apparently I got nicer. And that's helpful because
What do you mean, apparently you got nicer?
Well, my colleagues told me that, "You know what, you're easier to get along with now. You're not grumpy as much. You
oh,
don't
I see.
Snap at people." And, yeah, the answer was, look, we all know that. When, you know, if you're going to ask someone a favor, a colleague, And people say, by the way, so-and-so's in a super bad mood. So, well, let me wait until he's feeling a little more cheerful. Well, you know, there was a kind of a perennial low-level bad mood because I was going around being mad at myself because of this self-denial and what it did. Now, that's not just a matter of pulling tests. Being an effective legislator is helped by being nicer to people. Not always. I mean, people need to know that if you are treated badly, you will respond. Certain, you got to be tough and nice. I mean, the best thing I can say is this. Being effective in a legislative body has something in common with trying to be popular in high school. Actually, I mentioned that to one of my colleagues, Congresswoman Shelley Pingree, and she said, no, it's junior high school. I mean, there's a lot of personality that goes into it. And it's okay to be good at the job, but don't start looking like you feel too superior about it. So what happened was I just became better at the interpersonal aspects of legislating. And legislating is the most interpersonal thing. There's no hierarchy in a legislature. No member of the House of Representatives can order any other member to do anything. Some people are more influential than others. But if you're in any other job, there's generally a boss and someone can hire you, fire you. The only people who can fire a member of Congress are hundreds of thousands of people anywhere from hundreds of thousands of miles away. So the ability to get along with people and to persuade people to do what you want and to make that kind of situation work, it's very much a case where your personality helps. So I think I get better at my job because I did not have that negative thing weighing me down.
My guest is Barney Frank, the former Democratic congressman from Massachusetts. He thought being gay was incompatible with a career in politics, so he remained in the closet until 1987. But even while closeted, he advocated for gay rights legislation. He was elected to Congress in 1980 after serving 8 years in the Massachusetts state legislature. He retired in 2013, the year after he became the first member of Congress to enter into a same-sex marriage. His new memoir is called Frank. Once you were out, somebody named Herb Moses, who you describe as an openly gay Jewish man who edited an economics journal for the Department of Agriculture, contacted you, and you started a relationship with him that lasted several years, and you would go together to congressional social events. Was it awkward for you at first to actually be with a man with whom you were in an intimate relationship in a congressional kind of setting like that?
Well, yes, it was a little bit awkward. We had to be aware that we were entering some hostility. I tell you, it's one of two books I read in my life that I have actually used as a manual for how to behave. The first one was a very good book by a Columbia professor named Charles Hamilton about Adam Clayton Powell, who, while he was the third African-American to serve in the Congress in the 20th century, after the Reconstruction era, he was the first who was really basically willing to challenge prejudice. And when he got to the House, by the way, in 1942, he was told, or 44, 43, he was told he couldn't use the House gym or eat in the House restaurant or use the House barbershop. And he said, no, I'm going to do that. And he established, it seemed to me, a pattern that Herb and I decided we would follow. We would not refuse to do anything so somebody else could make a point. On the other hand, we wouldn't do something just to make a point ourselves. So we insisted on being treated the same as any other congressional couple, not legally because marriage obviously was not then a possibility. But we were aware that there were problems. And I'll give you the best example. We went to the annual Christmas party that presidents have for all members of Congress, a very elaborate black tie formal affair. And it was Reagan's last year. Next to last year, he and Nancy went up early, and so the members started. It became a dance party on the first floor of the White House. And Herb and I were standing there. And said, "Gee, we'd love to dance." You know, the kind of not ballroom dancing, but the kind of fast dancing facing each other. And we said, "Gee, do we? We wanted to dance. We didn't want to make a statement." But we didn't want prejudice to keep us from enjoying the party. So I approached two of my colleagues, later to become fairly well-known. They were the two congresswomen from San Francisco who, if they were caught helping two gay men, would benefit from it. One was later to become Senator Barbara Boxer. The other was Speaker Nancy Pelosi. So the four of us went out on the dance floor. And Nancy and I faced off, and Barbara and Herb faced off. And after a couple of minutes, they discreetly left the floor, leaving us to dance with each other. So that's the way we kind of had to deal with it.
So, like, you knew which members of Congress found the whole idea of homosexuality repugnant and sinful. Did you feel like their eyes were on you?
What I felt was, you know what, the reality is going to defeat the prejudice. And I think that's the basic reason we have made so much progress in diminishing homophobia. Okay, there was one member of Congress, former Congressman Dan Burton from Indiana, who apparently announced when he found out that I was gay, I was a pretty regular user of the House gym, that he was not going to use the House gym anymore because he was worried he might get AIDS from my being in the House gym. I don't know whether he was going to get it from the towel or what. It was never clear. In fact, later on, a few years later, when we were debating Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and some of the anti-gays in the military people said, well, you can't have straight men showering with gay men. That's a terrible thing. I was able to point out to them that many of them had been showering with me in the House gym for many years, and nothing at all interesting had happened.
So just a bit earlier, we were talking about why you came out and how you came out when you were in Congress. And things were going pretty much as planned for you in terms of coming out. And then this scandal happened. You had had a relationship with somebody named Steve Gobi, and you write about this in the book. And he was a man who'd worked as a male prostitute and a personal escort. And you write that for you, in the 2 years that you knew him, it had evolved into an ongoing non-sexual relationship, though you don't think that he thought that. He started working for you as, I think, a housekeeper and assistant. Was that, by the way, a cover, or was he literally working for you as a housekeeper?
No, you know what we did? He did my errands. You know, you're in Congress, and you're in Washington part of the time, and then you're running back to your district, and things like getting the dry cleaning become an issue. The normal errands, especially when you're single and you're just doing this. Some of my colleagues, very few, would use their staffs to run these kind of errands. I thought that was inappropriate. That's not what these younger, on the whole, professionals were hired for. So I first hired him to have sex. And after a couple of times, he was very intelligent, well-spoken. What I later learned was he'd been on heroin and had been arrested. He was on probation, and he was forced to stay off drugs. So he was on his very best behavior when I met him. And he was very clever. He clearly understood my emotional state, my sense of emotional and physical frustration. And he didn't see it as an ongoing sexual relationship. He thought, you know, he could get me to accept that we had this really good friendship. And that's the way it was. And then what happened, Frankie, was his probation expired, and he started to take drugs again and became kind of a jerk again. And by that time, I had come out, and I had a relationship with her, but I didn't need the kind of emotional support I thought I would be getting from him. There was a very small overlap. So once that happened, I told him that I did not care to I didn't need him anymore. That may be a little callous, but that, you know, the job I was paying him for, not much, wasn't going to exist. And that was the end of it. He got very angry. And here's where the blackmail came in. His first instinct was to kind of say, I'll tell everybody you're gay. Well, I said, I just did that. You know, it's been all over the papers in May of 87. So it's a little late for you to do that. He couldn't blackmail me. So he brooded about that for a couple of years. And then he went to the Washington Times, this very conservative paper that was then run by the Reverend Moon's organization, and told them about our relationship, because he couldn't make any points by saying I was gay. But yes, the fact that I had had a relationship with a prostitute was of some interest. He then elaborated that and added various charges about I was letting him run a prostitution ring for my apartment. What happened then was this went before the House Ethics Committee, and as I say in the book, I asked people just to read that report. They refuted or found no evidence for any of the charges. They did find that I had done two things wrong. I had let him use my privilege to avoid parking tickets when he borrowed my car. I had thought he was doing it to run errands for me. It turns out he was also doing it as part of his prostitution. And secondly, I had written a letter to the probation office about him. And in the letter, I lied. I said that I had met him at a party. I did not in that instance want to say that I met him by answering a sex ad. But those are the only two things that were found to be the case. But it was still humiliating for me, not just in terms of the public, but for me to recognize this. And by the way, that was a factor in my coming out. I mean, I started seeing him in 1985. and it was in 85, 86 that I finally decided to come out. That relationship, even as I was maintaining it, I realized it was certainly irresponsible for me as a member of Congress to risk the causes I cared about by this. It was a bad idea.
So after the House Ethics Committee issued their report, they recommended that you be reprimanded, which is the lowest form of punishment. And other people in Congress said, no, you should be expelled or you should be censured. And I read this, I read that, and I'm not sure if this is true or not, that one of the people who advocated censure and who wanted you expelled was Larry Craig, who later, shortly after this, was arrested for propositioning somebody who turned out to be an undercover cop in a men's room at the Minnesota St. Paul airport. So did he advocate for censure?
Yeah, he was one of the people who said I was a bad boy and I think voted for censure. It was led by Newt Gingrich. And Gingrich was really the one who people ask what happened to bipartisanship and when did partisanship become excessive? And it was through Newt Gingrich, and he consciously said that. This, you know, he starts in 95 when he becomes the speaker, but he had begun that in the 80s. And yeah, Larry Craig was one of the ones who voted for censure as opposed to reprimand.
And did you know that he had a secret homosexual life?
Well, there were rumors about it. There's a network, so that I would say this. A number of people were outed, more Republicans than Democrats, because the Democrats tended increasingly to sort of come out. Nobody who was outed surprised me. We had heard rumors about almost everybody. Not everybody about whom we had read rumors was outed. So there had been rumors about him, yes.
So very hypocritical, do you think, for him to have argued that you should be censured? And then...
Oh, yes. I formulated a rule that was really called within the LGBT community, in particular the Frank Rule, namely that the right to privacy does not carry with it the right to hypocrisy. And I applied that in my own case. When I decided I was going to run for office, I made two decisions. One, I cannot afford to come out right now. I won't win. This is 1972. But it would be despicable in my situation to be anything but a supporter of being gay. The notion that you participate in making illegal something which you personally do, you know, that's the absolutely, totally hypocritical. What was frustrating in some ways was that the press, in their view that you never expose anybody, were kind of tolerant of that. I would say to people, look, I don't think you should volunteer that someone is gay or lesbian in general. But if you've got a gay man who's voting to prosecute other gay men, I think that's relevant.
So what was your reaction when he was arrested for – when Larry Craig was arrested for propositioning a guy who turned out to be an undercover cop?
Well, there was a little used German schadenfreude, a little gloating, a little sense that, yeah, one more hypocrite bites the dust.
So you said you wouldn't out anybody in the House, but one of the things you advocated for was ending the special security clearances that were required for gay people working in government.
And I have to correct you. Yeah. We couldn't get security clearances.
Oh, that's right, one of the things, right, right.
This was one of the things that affected me early on. When I was 14, I don't remember that I remember that at the time, but it was clearly in the atmosphere. 1954, Dwight Eisenhower, who was not a bigot, who was a, you know, by today's Republican standards, was fairly liberal. He issued an executive order, binding executive order, that said homosexuals could not get security clearance, no matter what. And it wasn't even blackmail. The basis was not simply that we were security risks because we could be blackmailed. It was that we were bad people, that we were perverts, and that we lacked the moral fiber to do this. And not getting security clearance was a serious issue because it didn't just mean you couldn't go to work in the State Department or in the Defense Department. Contractors, architects, engineers, accountants who had contracts with these departments, you couldn't work for them because you would need a security clearance to do that. And that was a very serious problem for people.
And you advocated to have that overturned. And you said that if you write in your book that if House members were to assert that gay men were security risks, you would consider it, and you said this in the House, you would consider it your patriotic duty to provide a list of gay members of the House to the appropriate authorities. Were you actually were you prepared to do that and to actually
I don't know.
Out members of Congress?
Fortunately, Fortunately, it never came to that. I was pretty confident I wouldn't have to. I don't know what I would have done. I probably would have had to do it. Here's the deal, though, to give the background. Bill Clinton had genuinely, conscientiously tried to get rid of the ban on gays in the military. And we didn't have the votes to do it, and it was not. He's been unfairly blamed for that, although I think he did make a mistake by trying to claim that what we wound up with was much more of a victory than a loss, which it was a real loss. But after that, I went to the president. I was working with him. And said, look, a lot of gay and lesbian people are angry, and I'm disappointed because we weren't able to deliver on this, and people supported you, and you believe in this. I can give you a list of other things you can do that you don't have to have Congress in on that will help gay and lesbian people. And the most important was you as president can issue an executive order, in effect canceling Dwight Eisenhower's executive order, and remove any barrier, any obstacle to gay people getting security clearance, unless, like anybody else, we misbehave. And he agreed to do that. But once he did it in 1995, a very right-wing Republican, Robert Dornan from California, announced that he was going to try to do to the security clearance what the Republicans had done and Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And Don't Ask, Don't Tell, they said to Clinton, all right, you can't issue an order on this because we're going to pass a law that prevents it. So he threatened to pass a law that said that gay people were security risks. And it was at that point that I said, well, I obviously don't think we are security risks. But if that becomes the law of America, that gay people are against security risks, it will be my duty to report them. I frankly was pretty confident that that would get them back down. If it hadn't, I'm not sure what I would have done.
Why were you so confident? Were there that many right-wing, anti-gay Republicans that you could have outed that they backed down?
There were a few, but it was more this. There was not a lot of political opposition to security clearance. It was an easier issue to get them back down on. Gays in the military was tougher. And one reason for that was, and I take some credit for this, a few years before, as a member of the Budget Committee, I got to question Dick Cheney when he was then Secretary of Defense. Cheney's press secretary when he was in the House was a gay man from Wyoming whose name is Pete Williams. Pete's now out, and Pete's become a very respected reporter. I think he covered the Justice Department for NBC News. And Cheney took Pete Williams with him when he became Secretary of Defense. So Pete Williams is now the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Public Affairs, basically knowing everything that's going on in the Pentagon because he's got to tell people about it, and he's a gay man, a closeted. So when Cheney testifies before the Budget Committee, I was low level on seniority, so by the time they got to me, all the good questions about the budget had been answered, and I hate to ask somebody the question for the fifth time and hope that somebody will quote me on it. So I said, Ms. Secretary, I have a question to you. Gay people can't get a security clearance, and we're not allowed in the military. Is the reason that we're not allowed in the military that we're a security risk? And Cheney, to his credit, and as I've said, that's a phrase I rarely use, but Cheney, to his credit, said, no, Congressman, that's a bit of an old chestnut. It's not based on gay people being security risks. It's based on the fact that other members of the military would be against them. Now, what was interesting about this was when I asked Cheney the question about whether gay people were inherently security risks, I knew that his press secretary was gay. He knew that I knew. And I knew that he knew that. I knew that he knew that I knew. This could obviously keep going on. But as I've said before, Danny Kaye has to say that, not me. But what happened was, I kind of trapped Cheney. There was he could not defend the notion that gay people were security risks without opening. At that point, the press would have had to out his press secretary. Say, wait a minute, you're the Secretary of Defense. You say being gay makes you a security risk, and you hired a gay man to be your in charge of all the information. At any rate, that was very helpful. So that had weakened the argument for it. So by the time it became a political issue when Clinton removed it, they would have had a hard time winning that one, frankly, even without my threat.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Barney Frank, the former congressman, Democratic congressman from Massachusetts. He has a new memoir called Frank. Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Thanks for listening to Fresh Air. You might also want to listen to Microphone Check, hosted by Ali Shaheed Muhammad from A Tribe Called Quest and Franny Kelly. They talk to the biggest names in hip-hop and the best-kept secrets, from behind-the-scenes players to the next generation of rappers, producers, and artists. You'll learn what's happening in the culture now and how we got here. You can find Microphone Check at npr.org/podcasts. If you're just joining us, my guest is Barney Frank. The former Democratic congressman from Massachusetts has written a new memoir called Frank. You're married now. How does it feel? How does it feel to be able to use the words "my husband"?
Wonderful. Look, a lot of gay men and some agents find it hard to do that. I very much enjoy it. I think it's still part of my mission in terms of continuing the fight against prejudice. I get invited to speak and get paid for it. In retirement, I get paid a good deal of money to do the things I used to have to do for free all the time. That is, I had my basic salary, but go on television or make speeches or write. And I'm invited to speak to groups that are somewhat conservative, not socially conservative. They're very often financial groups, this or that financial institution or this or that company that specializes in this. And I frequently find occasion, I don't reach for it, but it's a natural thing to make reference to my husband. And I think having me stand there as a figure of some authority, talking to them about these subjects, they're paying me to do this. Obviously, that shows some respect. In fact, I try to do that all along. In fact, there was a period, and I made a point of saying, you know what, when we debated gay rights, I became the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee at a time when we had this financial crisis. I was a very important person. But I would say on occasion to my colleagues when the issue came up, look, I'm a big shot now. But I remember when I was 15 and I was terrified as a gay teenager. And in fact, in one debate we had about hate crimes, when some of the African-American members had been told by their preachers not to vote to give gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people hate crime protection because that would keep them from making any gay sermons. I said, no, it has nothing to do with free speech. Let me be very clear. This deals with violence. And I said, I think this is, frankly, an example where I could sort of bring the two together. I said to the Democratic caucus, if we pass this bill tomorrow, it would still be entirely legal to call me a fag. I just wouldn't recommend it if you were in the banking business.
That's funny. Do you think the Supreme Court will uphold the constitutionality of your marriage?
Yeah. Well, the constitutionality of my marriage is beyond them. Fortunately, because I would never want to underestimate the power of Antonin Scalia's homophobia. In fact, I must say it troubles me that he's now being sort of lionized as this cheerful guy. He's a bigot. And if he had ever expressed, and it goes back to, frankly, and I'm very glad you did this, let me go back to your opening question about racism. If Antonin Scalia expressed opinions about black people comparable to those he regularly expresses in written opinions about gay and lesbian people, he would not be considered a respectable guy. But here's the deal. Well, my marriage in Massachusetts is legal because the Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court found that right under the Massachusetts Constitution. But there were many states where that wasn't the case. I think this is very clear. First of all, if you look at Justice Kennedy, who would be the fifth vote here, he has voted for treating gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people equally in every case that's come before the Supreme Court. Secondly, when you had this rash of decisions in various appeals courts saying that states had to allow same-sex marriage, and the antis appealed to the Supreme Court to put that on hold until they decided, the Supreme Court refused. It would have made no sense for the court to have said, you know what, we're going to let all these people get married, but in about 5 months, we're going to cancel retroactively all those marriages. So I think that's pretty clear that they're going to uphold same-sex marriage.
So I have to ask you a Hillary Clinton question. You worked very closely with Bill Clinton when he was president. I'm sure you know Hillary Clinton well. Your sister was highly placed in Hillary's presidential campaign. So do you think she seems to be like the only leading contender for the Democratic presidential nominee right now? Do you think the email, the email scandal, email story, whatever word you want to use, is going to affect her chances of getting the nomination or affect her chances of winning the race if she does get the nomination?
Not unless something comes out of those emails, which I have no expectation will happen, that's negative. That is, unless I think the fact that she used private email rather than public email is not something that's going to move voters. That's an insider's problem. If it turns out that in those emails she was concealing something that was embarrassing, that will hurt her. I don't think it'll have any impact in the election, and I think it's in the nomination. And unless something bad comes out, it won't affect the election.
You kind of make fun of your own Jersey accent in the book. Did you ever try to lose it? Did you ever think, well, if I'm going to be in public office, I have to speak more kind of standard American dialect?
I didn't try to lose it. My mother, a wonderful woman who became a great advocate later in her life, did enroll me in elocution classes when I was 7 or 8, but it was a well-intended gesture, but it didn't work. No, in fact, what I learned how to do was it's kind of a political judo. I think I was able to make an asset out of some of my defects. For example, I have a hard time dressing well. Jim, God bless him, works very hard to keep me in good shape. But in my first campaign, somebody wrote an article and said I was wearing an ill-fitting suit. And I said, no, that's unfair. It was a well-fitting suit. It just – I wasn't the person it fit. And as a state representative, somebody took a picture of me in which I looked a little disheveled. And I put it up said, re-elect Frank, neatness isn't everything. So the same with my voice. You become kind of I think there is a certain blandness of politicians have that does not work to your favor. So if you can be somewhat distinctive in ways that are not offensive, I think that's helpful.
Barney Frank, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this. We had some good questions there.
Barney Frank's new memoir is called Frank. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Brandi Carlile is a singer-songwriter who has cited influences as various as Elton John, Patsy Cline, and Queen's Freddie Mercury. Her songs have been played prominently on TV shows such as Grey's Anatomy and Private Practice. Carlile has been releasing albums for the past 10 years, but rock critic Ken Tucker says her new one, called The Fire Watcher's Daughter, is her best yet.
I think it's time we found a way back home. You lose so many things you love as you grow. I miss the days when I was just a kid. My fear became my shadow, I swear it did. Wherever is your heart, I call home. Wherever is your heart, I call home. Though your feet may take you far from me, I know. Wherever is your heart, I call home.
Brandi Carlile has such a powerful voice, strong and surging and urgent with controlled emotion, that much of her previous work has showcased her vocals against a subdued background. In other words, it was easy to think of her in a folk or pop context rather than in terms of rock or country. But it's clear that one of Carlile's goals on The Fire Watcher's Daughter has been to expand not just into other genres, but into new degrees of intensity. She does this with great wit on the song Mainstream Kid, whose lyrics talk about the roles of the artist while the music has to leap to keep pace with her very enjoyable yelling.
I'm gonna fit in. I'm on the list. I'm gonna get in. Haven't you heard? Don't you know?
Throughout this album, Carlile works closely with Tim and Phil Hansroth, known as the Twins. They play guitar and contribute to the songwriting on the album, but it's their three-part harmonies with Carlile that make a big impact. This is especially true of a stripped-down song such as The Eye.
It really breaks my heart to see a dear old friend go down.
worn out place again. Do you know the sound of a closing door? Have you heard that sound somewhere before? Do you wonder if she knows you anymore? I wrapped your love around me like a chain, but I never was afraid that it would die. You can dance in a hurricane, but only if you're standing in the eye.
That song gives you some idea of what it was like to hear Carlisle and the Twins during a recent spate of concerts they gave called the Pin Drop Tour. It featured the trio singing and playing without microphones or amplifiers. Other songs here display another aspect of Carlisle's music, her connection to older styles of rock and roll. You can hear this in the rocking blues of Alibi. Songs on The Firewatcher's Daughter are wistful, sometimes melancholy elegies to times past, to relationships lost and others carefully nurtured. Family love is as important as romantic love. Ultimately, however, the album is about the sound of Brandi Carlile's voice, the way its strength can convey the vulnerabilities detailed by the lyrics, and how that neat paradox results in an aesthetic tension that sounds like freedom.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Yahoo TV. He reviewed Brandi Carlile's new album called The Fire Watcher's Daughter. Tomorrow on our show, I'll talk with Daniel Torday about his new novel. It's inspired in part by fabricated memoirs, false identities, and the story of his Jewish relatives in Hungary during World War II. It's called The Last Flight of Poxel West. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Last night I had the exact same dream as you. I killed a bird to save your life, and you gave me your shoes. You said, clip my wings and walk my miles, and I said I would too. Then I woke up, but I wasn't gonna tell you. Today I sang the same damn tune as you. It was Lady in Red, I hate that song, and I know you do too. You didn't catch me singing.